Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform with one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite.
Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stereo. netsuite.com/stereo.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Southern Fraud True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Listener discretion is advised. We know that about half of all marriages end in divorce. The data changes slightly year to year, but that unfortunate percentage stays about the same. And divorce is difficult no matter who you are or how much money you have, although a good therapist and support system certainly make it easier. But when children are involved, the stakes are so much higher. Some parents work very hard to make the experience as smooth as possible for their kids. It will still be a trauma. There's no avoiding some pain for the littles. But some marriages can end with minimal carnage for the kids. Other marriages that end, say, over infidelity are harder to mitigate. We think we can hide things from our kids, but they will always find out the truth, especially if that parent will then be in a relationship with the other lover afterwards. Even in the most civil of breakups, there will be damage done in these situations. The children must also adjust to a new adult in their life, often a new authority figure. Maybe not right away, but soon. And then we have the type of parents who weaponize their own children. Sometimes the kids are treated as pawns in a messy game of adult chess. Other children are quite frankly dropped in the middle of a battleground that they have no business being in. Parents bad-mouthing each other is awful, but sometimes it gets to the point that a judge must intervene. Some parents even lie during the custody phase, not just to hurt their former spouse, but to gain full custody, feeding their lies to their own children. We have a modern phrase for this now, parental alienation. It's not like it's a new problem. It's just that we are only starting to really talk about it. And you know how long it takes for legislation to catch up to anything. The courts are trying, but the system calls for psychiatrists and other professionals who must decide what is true, which is a huge burden, a responsibility that takes a lot of time and causes even more trauma. And those children in the middle are so confused. Brainwashed is not a pretty word and not one I use lightly. But there isn't a more concise way to explain what is happening to these kids. So they are truly weaponized. In today's case, one of those parents was also irresponsible with guns. A gun was not properly locked away from a child, and an unthinkable tragedy occurred. Welcome to episode 178, Parental Alienation and the Death of Dr. Rick Lostrow. Rick James Green was born on March 28th of 1963 to his father Richard and his mother Joanne in Spokane, Washington. Rick had two sisters and one brother. And although he was born in Spokane, He spent his childhood living in a few different states, including Idaho and Texas. Rick's father was in the U.S. Air Force from 1962 to 1966. So it's likely the Green family moved around for his dad's military job. Ultimately, Rick's parents settled down in South Carolina, and Rick made his home in Texas. As he entered adulthood, he decided to pursue medicine and become a doctor. He attended the Texas Tech School of Medicine in Lubbock. And then he completed his residency at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston. But when Rick graduated from medical school, he didn't become Dr. Rick Green, like you might think. Sometime during this period, Rick changed his last name from Green to Lostrup. We have no idea why Rick did it. Maybe there was another relative or authority figure in his life that he had admired. I do know many doctors choose to change their names before they are certified, because afterward, they cannot. They are legally required to get a fictitious name permit if they want to. Many do it to simplify a name that may be hard to pronounce or spell. So, for whatever reason, when Rick graduated from medical school, he was officially Dr. Rick Lostrow. And Dr. Rick Lostrow appeared to be doing very well. He became a pulmonary medicine specialist, meaning he helped diagnose and treat people's lung conditions. And he was also an assistant professor and emergency room care physician at the University of Texas Medical Branch, the same place he had completed his residency in the 90s. By 2004, Rick had also been married, had kids, and divorced. He had two sons. We will call the older son Aaron and the younger son Kurt. The boys were a few years apart. In August of 2004, Aaron was 10 years old and Kurt was 7. According to Rick's friends, he was a stellar dad. He loved his sons dearly and wanted nothing but the best for them. Rick's attorney, Kathleen Collins, said he was a man that did everything he could to help his children. They loved their father and Rick loved them. But Rick's ex-wife, Deborah, felt differently. Very differently. Deborah thought Rick was a terrible father. And maybe that's not surprising. As I said before, it could be for many reasons, from petty to a calculated bid for full custody. Still, the courts thought Rick and Deborah were both fit parents, and they both were granted equal custody of their two boys. So Rick and Deborah had to do what divorced parents do and figure it out. But it's safe to say they did not excel at figuring it out. At least one parent didn't. The result was a week-by-week custody arrangement. Aaron and Kurt would live with their mother Deborah in Katy, Texas for 1 week, and then the next week, they would live with their father, Rick, an hour and 20 minutes away in Friendswood, Texas. Every Friday, the boys would pack their bags and truck themselves over to whichever parent had them that week. The Lostrow boys found this arrangement to be pretty stressful. It is hard to uproot your life every 7 days, especially since their parents didn't live in the same town. Like I said, Katy and Friendswood are about an hour and 20 minutes apart. And if Katy sounds familiar, it's because I've covered two cases there, Belinda Temple and Fred Mangione. At 3:45 p.m. on Friday, August 27th of 2004, Aaron and Kurt had just gotten home. For the past week, they had been staying at their mother Deborah's home. Normally, they would do the switch-up process in the school parking lot, but the boys had a therapy appointment that afternoon. Since they weren't at school, Rick had to pick them up at Deborah's house. Now, he was waiting in Deborah's driveway. He parked his Toyota 4Runner and was sitting in the driver's seat. Deborah was helping Kurt tie his shoes, and Aaron had run off to get his backpack. Aaron came out of the house and climbed into his dad's SUV. He sat in the seat directly behind his father and began searching through his backpack. And that's when 10-year-old Aaron wrapped his hand around a .45 caliber semi-automatic pistol. Then he shot his father, 41-year-old Rick Lostrow, in the back. The first time Aaron pulled the trigger, the gun was still in his backpack. The bullet ripped through the bag and the back of the driver's seat before entering Rick's body. After the first shot, Rick started screaming. Later, Aaron would explain that his father's screams frightened him. So Aaron took the gun out of his backpack and shot his father several more times. After that, he got out of the car. Then, he fired off a few more shots toward his father's SUV. At least one hit the neighbor's car. Then Aaron ran inside his mother's house. Deborah took the gun away from him and called 911. An autopsy would later show that Rick died from 5 gunshot wounds to his back. Rick Lostro's 5th grader son shot and killed him. And he claimed that he did so out of fear, that he murdered his father to defend himself and his 7-year-old little brother. But why would Aaron feel that way? Why would he be so scared of his father, who was a respected medical professional? And how did he get a hold of that gun? I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break.
Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform with one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite.
Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stereo. netsuite.com/stereo.
If you like true crime, celebrities, or conspiracies, this story is for you. Remember where you were at mentally and emotionally during the pandemic? Now imagine you're being hacked, stalked, and manipulated by someone or something so powerful that it becomes a federal case. That's what happened to me. The Final War Podcast. Out now on all available platforms.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Deborah K. Geisler was born in August of 1969 in San Antonio, Texas. There, she graduated from John Marshall High School, and in December of 1985, she graduated from the University of Texas Health Science Center, where she had studied nursing. 2 years later, in 1987, Deborah met a handsome, aspiring doctor, Rick Lostro. At this time, Deborah was a nurse and Rick was a lab technician. They both lived in San Antonio, went to the same school, and worked in the same hospital. As soon as Rick and Deborah met, their connection was instant. They shared the same desire to help others, they were both hard workers, and they could see a future together. So less than 2 years after meeting, they were engaged. And on June 16th of 1989, 26-year-old Rick and 20-year-old Deborah married in Kendall, Texas. At first, their marriage seemed great. You know how it goes, the honeymoon phase. Everything feels fresh and new. It's fun to say, that's my husband or that's my wife. And starting your family, usually a wonderful time in married life. On January 21st, 1994, Rick and Deborah had their first son, Aaron. Then 2 years later, on June 6th, 1996, they had their second son, Kurt. Despite having two little bundles of joy, or possibly with their added stress, Rick and Deborah's marriage was slowly unraveling. It was like a pressure cooker. Each argument and stressor pressed on their relationship, building and building until it became explosive. Around this time, Rick was finishing up medical school, and Deborah was a practicing nurse. I'm sure Rick was racking up student loans and rarely home, while Deborah was trying to be the breadwinner and raising two little boys. Between their busy schedules, quick tempers, and growing family, Rick and Deborah's relationship went downhill fast. According to court documents, both Rick and Deborah were abusive in their marriage, verbally and physically. Over the course of several years, police officers visited their marital home over 20 times to help resolve various domestic disputes, some of which were violent. According to Deborah, Rick was arrested 7 times in total. The first time law enforcement came into their home in 1997, Rick was charged with assaulting Deborah. He was convicted, but his 1-year sentence was deferred. He never served time for it. Deborah was arrested several times as well, though it doesn't appear she was ever sentenced. The couple tried marriage counseling at Deborah's insistence. She wanted Rick to work on his angry outbursts, which is interesting, since Deborah contributed to their problems too. She once threatened to kill Rick by injecting him with insulin. Even therapy couldn't help this toxic relationship. Meanwhile, as Rick and Deborah were battling it out, their 2 sons watched. Aaron and Kurt witnessed their parents screaming, fighting, and everything else. Around the year 2000, when Aaron was 6 years old, Rick and Deborah were arguing, and as the situation escalated, Deborah said Rick threatened her with a hammer, that he chased her around their house holding the hammer. She said she hid in the master bedroom, but Rick found her, pinned her to the bed, with one arm against her throat and the hammer in his other hand. Deborah said Aaron, who had followed his parents into their bedroom, begged her to call the police. Eventually, someone did, though we aren't sure who. And when the officers arrived, no one was arrested, which seems to be the first time the police began questioning their conflicting stories. On January 2, 2002, another incident occurred. This time, it was at Aaron's 8th birthday party. Deborah had arranged for the whole family to play laser tag and eat Mexican food. But she didn't invite Rick, or at least Rick thought he wasn't invited. Either way, he was furious. When he did arrive, he and Deborah began a shouting match. Then Rick picked up a burrito and threw it at Deborah. She successfully dodged the burrito, which fell to the floor. As they kept fighting, Aaron got a small broom and dustpan to clean up the mess, which made Rick even more furious. He took the broom and dustpan and threw them at Aaron. The police were called again, and this time Rick was arrested, though we are not sure if he was convicted or sentenced. I am assuming there were more witnesses to this awful scene. In total, Aaron was present for 6 of the 7 times that Rick was arrested. After the birthday fight, Rick moved out of his family home. Less than a month later, on January 30th, he filed for divorce. In court, Deborah argued that she should have full custody. Even though she had been arrested herself, you can still probably empathize and see why she wanted full custody. But then she went further. She claimed that Rick had not only physically abused their sons, but sexually molested them as well. Deborah said that on April 1st, 2002, she heard 10-year-old Aaron and 7-year-old Kurt discussing sexual behavior. When she asked them where they heard this, Aaron said someone had told him to do something sexual. After Deborah pressed Aaron with more questions, he admitted that it was his dad, Rick, who had told him to do this sexual act. According to Deborah, Aaron then explained to her in explicit detail of an encounter where his father, Rick, sexually molested him 2 years prior in a motel room in Webster, Texas. Deborah called Child Protective Services and explained the situation. CPS immediately turned the case over to the Webster Police Department, which opened an investigation. During the investigation, CPS representatives, counselors, and police officers questioned Aaron. By the end of it all, the Webster Police Department determined that the allegations of sexual assault were not substantiated. In their eyes, Rick had not sexually molested his son. But Deborah was determined. She reported a different occurrence of Rick's supposed sexual abuse toward Aaron to the Galveston County authorities. This time, she claimed the abuse occurred in their previous family home in Friendswood, Texas. But the Galveston County detectives came to the same conclusion as Webster County. Rick had not sexually abused Aaron. It sounds like she was detective shopping, but this didn't stop her either. She took Aaron to a psychiatrist to talk about the alleged sexual abuse. Although two law enforcement agencies had determined there was no reason to file charges against Rick, Aaron maintained his story, and his psychiatrist confirmed that Aaron believed his father had sexually molested him. Whether it happened or not, the child did believe it. But how can that be true? How can a child say sexual abuse happened, even describing the situation, while two investigations found it false? There are only two possible answers here. Either the police departments were wrong, or Aaron was wrong. And there are people on both sides of the fence. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from today's sponsor. This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. Whether it's a work-life balance or managing your kids' schedules, not taking care of ourselves is a universal problem. Even if you pencil in some me time on your calendar, it might be the one thing on your to-do list that you don't check off. Therapy can give you the tools to find more balance in your life so you can keep supporting others without leaving yourself behind. Therapy has helped me with all kinds of serious issues, but also seemingly simple everyday life tools like setting personal boundaries so I am able to keep my work-life balance more even. And I learned to make private me time a priority rather than just a notation on a to-do list. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Find more balance with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Southern today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Southern. Child sexual abuse is a sensitive and complex issue to discuss. When it does happen, it's extremely hard to prove. The sexual predator is usually someone who has a lot of access to the child, like a parent or other close family member or babysitter. Because of that, there are rarely eyewitnesses or physical evidence. All you have is the word of a child against the word of an adult, and children are easily manipulated. And sometimes they lie. It's a natural part of being young. The National Children's Advocacy Center reports that 4-7% of child sex abuse allegations are false. Also, the National Library of Medicine found that 80% of children are susceptible to a phenomenon known as false memories. It is exactly what it sounds like. Kids are prone to suggestion. They might remember something just because someone said it happened. Many of us became familiar with this phenomenon with the McMartin preschool case in the 1980s. False memory syndrome happens when an adult uses suggestive questioning techniques on young children. I'm sure many of you are familiar with this case. It was the longest and most expensive criminal case in American history, which ended without one conviction. The investigation began in 1984, but the last trial ended in 1990. The original accusing mother was found to have been mentally ill and died of alcoholism before the trials even ended. And the social worker who used those methods to create false memories was discredited. But one mother caused mass hysteria at a daycare. It was an offshoot of the Satanic Panic, with the family that ran the daycare, the McMartins, also becoming accused of satanic rituals in addition to the sexual abuse. In that case, one mother became convinced her child was sexually assaulted because he had painful bowel movements. I am not digging that far into the case because that's not what today's episode is about. But suffice it to say, the mother's implanted memories in her son and the social worker made it worse. And then it was like a horrific set of dominoes that fell with each child that was questioned. That case was in California, or I would like to cover it, for the legal aspects as well as the psychological. But it is relevant here that one woman, one mother, could cause that much damage. The power that mothers hold over their child's psyche is incredible when you think about it. Many of Rick's friends and family believed that Deborah implanted memories in Aaron, that she told Aaron his father molested him so many times that after a while, Aaron just started to believe it. None of this is to say that Aaron was lying or that Deborah purposely influenced him to have false memories. I'm just pointing out that it's impossible to know what was going on behind closed doors, and as the police and CPS kept declining to prosecute or take any action against Rick, we have to consider other possibilities. Particularly parental alienation syndrome, or PAS. If you haven't heard of PAS, it's when one parent influences their child into hating the other parent for unjustified reasons. There is a loved parent and a hated parent. PAS is considered a form of emotional abuse. It can impair a child's ability to form future relationships, lower their self-image, lower their self-respect, cause anxiety and depression, lower their impulse control, and cause behavioral problems. According to Rick's friends and family, he and Deborah were a textbook case of parental alienation syndrome, with Deborah as the loved parent and Rick as the hated one. Rick's friends and family believed that Deborah intentionally poisoned their sons' minds against Rick. In a police affidavit, Rick's parents asserted that Deborah subjected the boys to a constant barrage of negative, derogatory statements about Rick. They thought Deborah was literally turning Aaron and Kurt against Rick. In fact, Rick's friends and family attributed 100% of their relationship issues to Deborah. They insisted she was the volatile one. She was the angry one. Rick was just trying his absolute best to appease her and raise his children. After Deborah reported Rick's alleged sexual abuse, he was not allowed to see his sons for months. It wasn't until September or October of 2002 that Rick was legally able to spend time with his kids again. So if Deborah did want to convince her sons to hate their father, that's a lot of mother-son time to get the job done. Now, obviously, Rick's friends and family loved him. They're going to see his side of the story. But we also cannot ignore that two separate police departments and CPS found the sexual allegations untrue, and that when a judge was presented with all the facts, they still decided to grant joint custody to both Rick and Deborah. Rick's lawyer, Kathleen Collins, said, "There isn't a judge I know of who's going to approve and grant joint custody in any situation where the judge believes there is credible evidence of sexual abuse." This is one of those situations where every action can be viewed through two lenses. Maybe Deborah was a woman desperately trying to save her two sons from an abusive father. Or maybe Deborah was, as Rick's people believed, on a mission to smear Rick's name. Frankly, it's impossible to know for certain. What we have are the cold, hard facts. And facts don't always leave room for nuance. After the divorce was filed and custody was decided, Rick and Deborah began dating other people. And the boys started their new one-week at mom's house, one-week at dad's house custody plan. But this wasn't the end of Rick and Deborah's feuding. If anything, the strain of co-parenting made their relationship worse. In the fall of 2002, Rick had picked up the boys from an after-school program. But this was technically before his sexual molestation investigation was over, so Rick wasn't legally allowed to pick his sons up. As a result, Rick faced criminal trespass charges. It's likely Deborah was the one who reported Rick, but we don't know for sure. I am not sure why he would do this, probably knowing it would hurt his case. This is a very confusing part of this case. Here's an exact quote from an appeals document. "As a result of the sexual abuse allegations, Lostro was denied visitation with the children, but in September of 2002, he regained visitation rights. On October 4th, 2002, Lostra retrieved both boys from after-school care in violation of a protective order. End quote. No further clarification about those dates was given. It is unclear exactly when the sexual abuse investigation was dropped. We just know that a custody agreement was set by a judge, and that same fall, Rick was allowed to see his children again. So he may not have gotten in trouble for that incident once the courts sorted it out, and he may not have realized he was violating the order since he had won custody. Why would he just go pick them up if it was not his week? He didn't do things like that. He obeyed the court orders every time. But anyway, that same fall, we do know Deborah reported Rick to the police. Apparently, Aaron and Kurt never wanted to go to their father's house when it was his week of custody. The two boys were purposefully slow to pack their things and would often refuse to get into Rick's car. On multiple occasions, Rick had to call the police and have them help convince the boys to get in his car. This weekly ritual became a nightmare. Deborah stayed in the house during these altercations. She never helped convince the boys to go with their father. And when Deborah did come out of the house, she and Rick would always end up fighting. It's difficult, at least to me, to understand Deborah's actions at this point. The court had spoken. Why not make her sons' lives less miserable and accept the situation? Help them to accept it. Instead, she seemed determined to make it worse. Maybe she thought all this drama from the boys' refusal would eventually help in court. And it was major drama. One time, Aaron and Kurt were so desperate to stay at their mother's house that they jumped out of their father's moving car. Luckily, Rick wasn't going very fast, so nobody was hurt. On another occasion, Aaron sprayed his father with a garden hose as he sat in the car waiting. At least once, Rick gave up and left without his sons, foregoing the custody agreement for that week. Which does give me greater empathy for Rick. If his visits were causing all this stress and drama, then it wasn't good for his sons, and he knew that. But evidently, he eventually felt like enough was enough. So on Friday, November 14th, 2002, when Aaron didn't want to go with his father, Rick grabbed his son's arm and forced him into the vehicle. On the way to Rick's house, Aaron complained that he didn't want to be there. In response, Rick allegedly hit him. After they got home and went inside, Aaron said Rick hit him again. But this time, he said the hit was much harder. Aaron said he fell and hit his head on the sofa's armrest. As soon as Aaron told his mom about this, she called the police. But no charges were filed. And you have to wonder why no charges were filed. The descriptions I just gave you came from Aaron, not Rick. We can't know the real truth. I'm sure Rick was exasperated and couldn't help but be angry, but with all else going on, it's difficult to believe Rick would do anything to jeopardize his custody rights. But Aaron did start seeing a psychologist after this. 4 days after that incident, when Rick was not charged, on November 18th, Deborah went to Rick's new girlfriend's place of employment. Her name was Katie. Deborah told Katie's coworkers that Rick was a child molester, and she also told Katie to stay away from her two sons. When Katie left work to go home that day, she saw Deborah watching her from her car. And Deborah wasn't alone. She had Aaron and Kurt in the car with her. Okay, are we starting to see a pattern? A very damaging and hateful pattern. And it gets worse. Nervous, Katie got in her car and drove away, only for Deborah to follow her. Deborah drove recklessly to keep up with Katie. She ran multiple red lights and tailgated Katie. The only time Deborah finally stopped following her was when Katie purposefully drove past a police station. Afterward, Katie reported Deborah to the authorities, and Deborah was charged with neglectful supervision of her children. See, now these charges were somehow found credible. It speaks to what trained officers were seeing when questioning the boys. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break.
Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform with one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite.
Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stereo. netsuite.com/stereo.
If you like true crime, celebrities, or conspiracies, this story is for you. Remember where you were at mentally and emotionally during the pandemic? Now imagine you're being hacked, stalked, and manipulated by someone or something so powerful that it becomes a federal case. That's what happened to me. The Final War Podcast. Out now on all available platforms.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
A month later, on December 19th, Deborah told the police that her sons had witnessed Rick hit his new girlfriend, Katie. Strange that she would care about Katie, but honestly, it looks like she was trying anything to make Rick appear to be abusive. When the detectives interviewed both Aaron and his little brother, Kurt, Aaron confirmed that he saw the abuse happen. Aaron said they were in an argument about unwashed dishes when Rick struck Katie. As Aaron spoke with police officers, Deborah interrupted. She said, "What I'm really concerned about is that Rick spanked my sons." At this, the officers looked to Aaron. They asked if his father had spanked him, which Aaron confirmed. Aaron explained that Rick had used his belt to whip him 3 times when he had refused to go to bed. Then Deborah added that Rick had threatened to kill the boys. Aaron and Kurt did not initially report this detail. But when the police asked if Rick had said those things, the boys looked at their mother, then looked at the officers and said yes. The officers referred the incident to their detective division for further investigation, but nothing came of it. From their description and the fact that Rick was not charged, it sounds like they thought maybe the boys were being coached. I want to point out that it doesn't matter whether or not you agree with corporal punishment. It's a personal decision. The point here is whether or not it's even true. That spring, on April 8th, 2003, Aaron allegedly told his mom that Rick had beaten him again. 2 days before, Aaron was at his dad's house, and Rick had wanted him to take a bath, but Aaron refused. So Rick allegedly chased his son into the bathroom while wielding his belt and then forcibly removed Aaron's shorts and beat him across his backside with the belt. Next, Rick allegedly wrangled Aaron into the bath. While relaying this story to his mom, Aaron showed her a bruise on his elbow. Deborah called the police. Aaron told the investigators that he was afraid to take a bath at his father's house because Rick had molested him in the past. Later that month, on April 24th, peace officers responded to another call from Deborah. She explained to them that while Aaron was at his father's house the day before, Rick had hit him in the face. According to Aaron, he had asked his dad if he could play a video game. When his dad said no, he asked again and again. After the 4th time Aaron asked, Aaron said Rick became frustrated and hit him. But the investigating officers did not see any marks on Aaron's face, and it's clear that they had lost trust in Deborah. One officer wrote in his official report, "Due to my past experiences with Mrs. Geisler, I did not see any reasons to pursue the issue of assault on the 9-year-old boy. I told Mrs. Geisler that the child's father had the right to discipline his child as long as it was not excessive. On May 21st, 2003, Rick and Deborah were officially divorced. Over a year had passed since the initial filing. The next month, in June, Deborah married her second husband, a man named Matthew Swanson. Unfortunately, Deborah and Matthew's relationship was also abusive. Not long after their marriage, Matthew was arrested for assaulting Deborah. Soon after, Deborah filed for a restraining order against Matthew. As I read over this case, my heart ached for Aaron and Kurt. They were dealing with a lot. Their parents' messy divorce, a complicated custody situation, two parents dead set against each other, and now their mom's new abusive husband. On May 14, 2004, a year after the divorce, Deborah filed yet another police report. This time, she accused Rick's girlfriend, Katie, of abusing her youngest son, Kurt. In the police report, an officer wrote the following: "There is concern that Aaron and Kurt are still at risk for physical abuse, especially because Lostro has a condition called intermittent explosive disorder. This causes him to have outbursts of anger, and Lostro is not taking his medication. To my knowledge, there is no other public information available regarding Rick's mental health diagnosis. I have no idea if that's even true or if it's just something Deborah said to the police. But if he did have this disorder, it's unclear how much it affected his behavior toward his sons. And you would think it would be an issue with custody. Evidently, it was not, as Rick was awarded equal custody. But anyway, it also seems like the accusation that Katie abused Kurt was unfounded. At the very least, Katie wasn't charged. At what point do you think that Deborah became the boy who cried wolf? At what point can someone be charged with filing false reports? She was wasting precious resources. Do you have any idea how many abused children there are out there who need these resources? While Rick and Deborah were charged with abusing each other, Rick was never charged with abusing his sons. The accusations did not appear to be legitimate to a number of different officers, detectives, and CPS officials. That summer, in July of 2004, Aaron began seeing a psychiatrist at the Texas Children's Hospital. Her name was Dr. Diane Treadwell Deering. She determined that Aaron showed some signs of depression, so she prescribed him Prozac. They began with a daily 10-milligram dosage and increased it to 20 milligrams over time. If you aren't familiar, Prozac is an antidepressant medication, sometimes known as fluoxetine. It's an SSRI, which stands for Selective Serotonin Reuptake Inhibitor. It increases the amount of serotonin in the brain, which can help people feel happier. And just the year before, it had been approved by the FDA as a treatment for children and adolescents. As Dr. Deering continued to increase Aaron's Prozac prescription, his mother, Deborah, became worried. She was concerned that when Aaron spent a week with his father, he wouldn't take the Prozac medication regularly. Dr. Deering understood Deborah's concern. She had tried to call Rick to discuss Aaron's new medications, but Rick never picked up or returned her calls. "I wonder if he disagreed with medicating his son, but you would think he would want to express that to Dr. Deering. But he was an incredibly busy man, and maybe he just saw this as yet another Deborah issue. It's hard to say. I only wonder because Rick was a doctor himself." So Dr. Deering prescribed Aaron a 90-milligram dose of Prozac and a time-release capsule. That way, Aaron would only have to take the pill once a week, eliminating the fear that Aaron wouldn't stay on his meds while at his dad's house. One pill is much easier to keep track of than seven. Even though Aaron was being treated for depression, he appeared to be doing okay. He hadn't displayed any concerning behaviors. Aaron's lawyer later said, "He's really a pretty well-adjusted young man for what he's been through with the divorce and the other things in his life." On Friday, August 27, 2004, Aaron and Kurt visited a psychologist named Dr. Charles Patrick Brady. They went to Dr. Brady at Dr. Deering's recommendation. To prepare for the appointment with Dr. Brady, Deborah asked her sons to write down all the things they wanted to talk about. Aaron wrote a list of topics, which I will read for you now. I've edited a little for readability, but it's almost exactly what Aaron wrote. I also want to give you a trigger warning because this can be very upsetting, and I'm going to try not to stumble through it because of the stilted wording. Number one, I'm angry because I have to go live at my dad's. It upsets me a lot to stay at Rick's. Number two, Rick yells and screams at us a lot. Number three, Katie calls us names like turd, brats, pigs, nerds. There's a lot of yelling at Rick's house. Number four, Rick hits us, swing his fists at our head, whips us with belts. He's hit me and knocked me down. He hits me because he is mad. He gives us bruises and cuts. Number five, he yells at Katie using bad words. He has also hit her, and Katie has hit him sometimes. He also yells at her about smoking. Number six, when Rick comes to pick us up at Mom's house, he yells and screams at us. He grabs Kurt, hurting him, and forces Kurt into his car. I try to protect Kurt. Number seven, Rick yells and screams bad words at other drivers. Rick swerves the car. He slams on the brakes in front of other drivers to make them mad or because he is mad. He also does bad hand movements to other drivers and other people. Number eight, one time Katie shoved me out the back door at night and locked me out of the house. Kurt was the one who let me back in the house. She broke glass. Katie whips Kurt with a belt, and I cannot stop her from hurting him. Number nine, Rick has pictures of naked women on his computer that pop up. Then Rick has tapes of naked women. Number 10, I think Rick is doing bad things to Kurt like he did to me. When I come home from school sometimes, Rick has Kurt in Rick's bed, and Rick is in his underwear. Kurt is quiet and sad. Rick is acting strange. Kurt has told me what Rick has done, and I cannot protect Kurt from this happening. No one could protect me when this was happening. Number 11, Kurt and I have both been sick, and Rick does not take us to see our doctor. I had a fever for 4 days, and Rick did not help me. Kurt had a fever, a skin infection, sore throat, and Rick did not take us to the doctors. Number 12, I'm afraid of Rick and living at Rick's house. I wish I could make things better and protect Kurt. I want to live at my mom's house so things don't continue to hurt Kurt and me. Katie carried a machete around Rick's house and said, "I'm going to rip up your dad. I don't feel safe at Rick's house because he is angry a lot and is doing bad things." End quote. Did Deborah coach Aaron as he wrote this list? And if so, was her guidance helpful or manipulative? It's unclear. Remember, the list was her idea in the first place, not the psychologist's. It's interesting that there isn't one thing about being at his mother's house on this list. If it is an honest list without coaching, you can see how that's a problem. His mother was in an abusive marriage. She was constantly causing drama. How could she not make the list? Except she pretty much made the list herself. Think about number 11 when he says Rick won't take them to the doctor when they are sick. Rick was a doctor. Some of this just doesn't make sense. But this is the list Aaron and Deborah said he wrote. So with this list in hand, Aaron went to meet with the psychologist, Dr. Brady. Afterwards, Dr. Brady agreed that Aaron believed he had been sexually assaulted by his father, which is different than saying he agreed that Aaron was sexually assaulted by his father. But more than that, Dr. Brady could tell that Aaron thought that Rick was going to sexually assault his little brother, Kurt, too. After the session, Dr. Brady advised Deborah to call CPS. I'm sure this was an abundance of caution, and also to legally let CPS sort it out. There was little the psychologist could do legally about the case except give a statement. He actually could report the abuse himself if he believed it happened, and the fact that he passed it off to CPS is somewhat telling to me. Doctors have a legal duty to report abuse. As Deborah drove her sons home, she asked Kurt if his father had assaulted him. Kurt said no. This made Aaron extremely angry and agitated, which was strange for Aaron. He was usually a calm boy. Then, Deborah ran out of gas. She and the boys had to wait several hours for a tow truck to give them a ride to a gas station. Once they finally arrived home, there was no time for snacks or unwinding. The boys had to pack for their dad's house right away. It was a stressful situation. Try getting two cranky kids under the age of 10 out of the house, even without underlying issues. And this was a combustible situation already. Sometime in between getting towed and packing for Rick's house, Deborah handed Aaron his once-a-week dose of Prozac, and he took it. This was only the second time he had ever taken the 90-milligram pill, but Aaron wasn't a fan. He said the pill made him feel, quote, a little on the side of angry. As the two boys were getting ready to go to Rick's house, Deborah called CPS, just like the psychologist recommended. During that call, Rick then called Deborah. He had just driven into the driveway and was letting her know he was ready for the kids. At this point, Deborah and Rick began fighting. And that's when Aaron went into his mother's bedroom closet, grabbed her .45 caliber semi-automatic pistol, loaded it, and put it in his backpack. Kurt recalled seeing Aaron leave the house with his backpack slung around his shoulders. Then, Kurt heard several loud pops, and Aaron returned inside with a gun in his hand. Deborah and Kurt looked at Aaron in shock, and Aaron, using his non-gun hand, made the okay hand signal. Deborah asked Aaron, "What did you do?" And Aaron replied, "I shot him." I'm going to pause now for a final commercial break.
If you like true crime, celebrities, or conspiracies, this story is for you. Remember where you were at mentally and emotionally during the pandemic? Now imagine you're being hacked, stalked, and manipulated by someone or something so powerful that it becomes a federal case. That's what happened to me. The Final War Podcast. Out now on all available platforms.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Deborah then realized what had happened, and she took the gun away from Aaron. Next, she called 911 and ran outside to check on Rick. She told the 911 dispatcher that Rick was alive, but barely. His breathing was shallow and labored. When the EMTs arrived on the scene, they tried to treat Rick, but at that point, he was gone. He had been shot 5 times in the back and once in the left arm. When the police arrived, they separated Aaron from his mother and little brother. They placed bags on his hands to help preserve evidence, and they immediately questioned Deborah. How did this little boy get a hold of her gun? Deborah said she didn't know. She claimed that her pistol was always locked away and always unloaded. But that wasn't true. Aaron did load the gun himself, but it wasn't in a locked case, just a zipped one tucked in the back of Deborah's closet. As the detectives questioned Aaron, Aaron explained that Rick abused him. Aaron also said that he worried his father sexually molested Kurt, and that bothered him a lot. Aaron described the abuse the same way he had to CPS, psychologists, and other police officers. He recounted that Rick had molested him a few years ago in a motel. And Aaron said that his father was quick to beat him when he was mad. The detectives asked Aaron what happened after Rick got here today, and Aaron whispered, "I was mad that I had to go with him, so I shot him." Officers asked Aaron if he was afraid of Rick, and Aaron responded, Yes. Oh, yeah, I was scared of him. When he'd get angry, I was real scared that he would turn around and just go crazy on us, hit us, and abuse us. When asked why his father came to get him every week, Aaron said, "I don't know. I don't. I just think he thinks that we're like a prize to him, not as loved, but like as if he were playing a game." I'm sorry. That's not how children talk. That's way too sophisticated for a fifth grader. He was saying this after having shot his father, but it sounds parroted from something Deborah would say. After the investigators were done questioning Aaron, they took him into police custody. He spent several weeks at the Harris County Juvenile Detention Center's psychiatric facility. During this time, state prosecutors were deciding whether or not to charge Aaron with murder. I've covered a lot of cases, and in every single one, I cannot fathom the grief that a victim's family feels. It is always unimaginable. But this case hits much harder. There's a child who made a mistake, a forever mistake. If you take anything away from this case today, please make sure your guns are locked away securely. At first, Deborah wouldn't speak to the local newspapers, but after a time, she did. When reporters asked Deborah why Aaron would kill Rick, she said that he was very angry with his father, and she explained to them how neither of the boys wanted to spend time with Rick. "My son is not a homicidal maniac," Deborah told the Houston Chronicle. "I knew my son was angry with his father, but I never thought my son would see this as a way to handle the hopeless situation he thought he was in." Neighbors supported Deborah's claim. They saw how much of a struggle it was whenever Rick arrived to pick up the boys. Okay, first of all, thanks, nosy neighbors, who don't really know any of these people. Second of all, did Deborah think she was doing her son any favors by saying these things to reporters? That's unconscionable to me. You don't talk to the press when your 10-year-old son could be charged with murder. Full stop. And many people, including Rick's lawyer, thought the whole situation was suspicious. Rick's divorce lawyer, Kathleen Collins, said, "I don't think the child pulled the trigger by himself." The police found gunpowder on both of Aaron's hands and on Deborah's right hand. And when they asked Deborah if she killed Rick early on, she didn't immediately respond. After some time passed, Deborah used her Fifth Amendment privilege to remain silent. Later in court, Deborah would clarify that no, she did not kill Rick. After that, the matter was dropped. The state didn't pursue Deborah's culpability any further. She could have gotten the gunpowder residue on her right hand when she just took the fired weapon away from her son. But I really don't like that Fifth Amendment business. If she didn't do it, why wouldn't she be adamant to the police? Rick's parents, Richard and Joanne Green, were devastated. Their son was dead at the hands of their grandson. It was unimaginable. They wanted to know if something else was going on. But unlike Rick's friends, they didn't just pin Aaron's unexpected violence on his mother, Deborah. They attributed Aaron's actions to his new 90-milligram Prozac medication. If you'll recall, Aaron did say it made him feel a little angry. So Richard and Joanne sued the makers of Prozac, known as Eli Lilly and Company. Their lawsuit claimed that Prozac's negative side effects had, quote, created a mental state in which Aaron suffered emotional instability, agitation, depersonalization, hostility, and mania, leading to violence on the day that his father was killed. Eli and Company's public response was that they did not promote Prozac for pediatric patients. Sure, the medication had been approved by the FDA for children aged 8 or older with depression, but they were not marketing it for that demographic. Most experts do not believe Prozac causes violence. Rather, people who are taking Prozac for anxiety or depression might already be prone to violence due to their own pre-existing emotional turmoil. Many depression medications list the same possible side effects. It is unclear if Richard and Joanne won or lost their lawsuit against Prozac. Based on the lack of documents available, the parties probably reached a settlement and the Greens signed a non-disclosure agreement. Another sad note to this case is after this, at least one paper that I saw, the New York Post, called Aaron Prozac Boy. Richard and Joanne Green also sued Deborah and her new husband, Matthew. They accused the couple of negligence. There was speculation that perhaps Deborah had accidentally given Aaron two of the 90 milligram time-released Prozac capsules instead of the prescribed one. Remember, that day was frantic. The boys had a therapy appointment. The car had run out of gas, and everyone had to rush to pack for Dad's house. It would have been a stressful few hours. It wasn't unreasonable to wonder if Deborah had misremembered how many pills she had given her son. But this was never confirmed. Still, Rick's parents' lawsuit claimed that Deborah, as a nurse, had a duty to administer the medication only as prescribed and to monitor her son for the adverse reactions or side effects. And the lawsuit also claimed that Deborah and Matthew didn't properly secure their gun or ammunition, which is absolutely true. Additionally, Richard and Joanne fought for temporary custody of Aaron and Kurt. Not only did the grandparents want to remove the boys from the influence of their mother for their emotional health, they were concerned that Deborah had inadvertently caused Rick's death. When Deborah purchased the gun that killed Rick, she had brought both of her young sons with her. They had watched the salesperson explain how to unload it, reload it, and shoot it. We don't know how young the boys were when this purchase took place, but logically, Aaron must have been no older than 10, and Kurt must have been no older than 7. The courts agreed with Rick's parents. Aaron and Kurt should be in their custody, not Deborah's. But when it came time to actually give Kurt to their paternal grandparents, nobody could find him. Deborah had taken Kurt and disappeared, completely ignoring the court's order to deliver her sons to their grandparents. At this time, Aaron was still in the state's custody. Deborah's attorney, Chris Tritico, claimed to have no clue where Deborah and Kurt had gone. He said, quote, "There is no basis to show Ms. Geisler is an unfit mother. There is every belief those children belong with her." No, sir, only your belief at this point. And so what anyway? As her lawyer, he should be advising her to follow court orders. But he was grandstanding, because he also accused the grandparents of manipulating Aaron by asking him to tell them what happened on the day of the shooting. Tritico told papers, quote, "I can't allow a 10-year-old to be manipulated into saying things that are going to be used against him later. It works against this young man's ability to get a fair trial, and it has to stop." So does talking to the press, which, as far as we found, the grandparents weren't doing. After 2 days on the run, Deborah finally handed over Kurt to his paternal grandparents on September 10th of 2004. According to their grandfather, Kurt was excited to hang out with Grandma and Grandpa. While all of this was happening, Aaron was still in a juvenile detention center. On October 1st, 2004, he was charged. The state now formally accused Aaron of engaging in delinquent conduct for fatally shooting his father, Rick. There was a jury trial, but due to Aaron's status as a minor, no media was allowed. But we were able to glean the major arguments. Aaron's legal team argued that he shot his father in self-defense. According to them, Aaron was so frightened of going to his father's house and also worried for his brother's safety that he killed his father to protect them both. The defense wanted Aaron's current charge to be dropped and for Aaron to accept a new charge related to self-defense. Aaron's lawyers also suggested that, as I said before, Deborah gave Aaron two doses of Prozac. If that was true, then Aaron had overdosed, and as such, he couldn't be responsible for his actions. Despite these arguments, the jury found Aaron guilty. Due to Texas laws, the jury not only decided Aaron's guilt, but also his sentence. They could have given him anywhere from just probation to 40 years in prison. So in September of 2005, a year after the shooting occurred, the jury sentenced 11-year-old Aaron to 10 years of confinement in the Texas Youth Commission. Aaron would be eligible for parole in 3 years as long as he completed the appropriate resocialization programs. If Aaron didn't make parole by the time he became an adult, he would be transferred to the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. DA Bill Hawkins, who prosecuted the case, felt the jury put Aaron's fate in his own hands. He said that Aaron held the key to the gates, since parole was achievable and only a few years. When asked, jury members rationalized their sentence by saying they did not want Aaron to return to his mother's home. They believed the young man needed more emotional stability than she could provide. But the general public wasn't so sure about this solution. Aaron would still be in a new environment, surrounded by criminals. Was the Texas Youth Commission truly better than being with Deborah? But it had been decided. Deborah tried to console Aaron by telling him the whole situation was like being away at camp and following camp rules. He'd get up before dawn, follow a schedule, eat 3 meals a day, and go straight to bed. He'd cut his hair in a military-style crew cut and wear an orange jumpsuit. And if Aaron worked hard and did well, he could earn the ability to wear a polo and khaki slacks. Deborah told reporters that she wouldn't abandon her son. She said, "No matter where he goes, I'll visit him. I'm not the mother from hell. I'm just a normal parent who is in a very difficult marriage, but I love my children." Around this time, Rick's friends created a foundation against parental alienation syndrome. They purchased several billboards in the Houston area. The billboards displayed a child's drawings of a mother saying, "Our daddy doesn't love you anymore." And the caption says, "Don't turn your kids against their mommy or their daddy." They lobbied the American Psychiatric Association to recognize PAS in the DSM-5, which would make it a real medical diagnosis. Today, the DSM-5 includes symptoms of PAS under child emotional abuse, but it's not its own separate entry. And that is what I mean by legislation taking forever. We have to wait for psychiatry to catch up before the law can even begin to, particularly custody law and CPS standards. In December of 2008, Aaron appealed his case and, in a rare occurrence, won. Aaron's legal team argued that Aaron should have been allowed to bring in an expert to the stand, one that could talk about self-defense and educate the jury about its nuances. The traditional discussion of self-defense is simple for everyone to understand. Someone tried to harm me, so I had to harm them to save myself. But this expert witness would have taught the jurors that there is a version of self-defense where a victim anticipates their abuser's danger. So even though Rick wasn't in the act of harming Aaron at the moment of his death, Aaron knew that Rick would hurt him soon. In Aaron's eyes, it was inevitable, and the only way he could stop it was to preemptively strike. This would be similar to the battered woman syndrome argument. For the record, battered woman syndrome is listed as a subcategory under post-traumatic stress disorder in the DSM-5. It is also not recognized as a diagnosis either. I've covered cases of this, most recently the Susan Wright case in episode 170. Whether you believe in these arguments or not is up to you, but Aaron's lawyers weren't worried about that. They were only arguing that, hey, the judge should have at least let us bring a self-defense expert to testify, which frankly I agree with. As long as the expert witness is accredited with the courts, it is fair. And the appeals court agreed. They overturned Aaron's conviction and started the process for a new trial. While awaiting for his new trial, 14-year-old Aaron was released on bond. He stayed with Deborah's 75-year-old mom, his grandmother, in San Antonio. Aaron's little brother, Kurt, had moved to South Carolina to live with their paternal grandparents. And Deborah continued to fight for custody of her two sons, but was not successful. So Aaron was given a new trial, but this time, his case never made it to court. He pled guilty to all charges in October of 2011. He was sentenced to probation, which was set to end when he was 18 years old in January of 2012, 11 years ago. And as far as we can tell, that's exactly what happened. Today, Deborah still lives in Texas. She was never charged for anything. This is a hot-button issue, and I'm going to catch a lot of flack for this, but I do believe that our laws have not caught up to the very real and devastating issue of gun violence in this country. I do believe that parents and other adults who fail to responsibly lock up their firearms should be culpable, somewhat at least, in cases like this. They could be charged, along with the minor child, with negligence at the very least, if not reckless endangerment. This is just my opinion. Everyone has one. Johns Hopkins University reported that almost half of American gun owners don't keep their guns locked up. These guns are not in a locker. They aren't in a gun cabinet. Millions of unsecured guns are half-heartedly hidden, stuffed in the back of closets, forgotten in the bottom of nightstands, or just lying in the bottom of a purse. And that is a big problem. About 4.6 million children live in a home with an unlocked, fully loaded firearm. 75% of kids who live at home with guns know exactly where they are, and studies have indicated that even if a child has been explicitly taught not to touch a gun, most children still will. Originally, I was going to recite several devastating cases, but you've heard them all before. I think the most recent was the 6-year-old in Virginia who took his mother's gun and shot his teacher. We read or hear about these cases all the time, and yet we are still waiting for some common sense gun laws. Tragically, there are thousands of cases like these, and today we only covered one of them. Dr. Rick Lostrow may not have been a perfect husband or a perfect man, and he had a stressful career as an emergency room doctor on top of his other problems, but he still loved his sons. There is no hard proof that Rick ever really abused his sons, much less sexually abused them. There is much more evidence to suggest that his ex-wife did everything in her power to turn his own sons against him. She poisoned Aaron's mind. She may not have intended for this tragedy to happen, but she did set the dominoes up. Rick was a 41-year-old man doing the best he could. That is so young. The older I get, the younger 41 sounds. Aaron would now be about 30 years old, a man now himself. I hope that he received the therapy he needed to come to grips with what he did and somehow heal. I hope he remains in therapy for a long time. I could not imagine having to live with this. Southern Fried True Crime is hosted and produced by me, Erica Kelly. Today's episode was researched and written by Andrea Marshbank and me. And of course, all editorial opinions are my own. Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio, and the original graphic art is by Cully Horner. Today's episode was edited and mixed by Brandon Schecksnyder of Southern Gothic and Erica Kelly. If you have any case suggestions, please go to my website and click on the listener suggestion tab or email sftcresearch@gmail.com. You'll get lost in a sea of emails if you send it to my main address, so this is the best way for me to get to those little-known cases y'all always send me. Please remember that I do not accept suggestions on social media private messages. With 3 platforms to manage, that is very overwhelming for me. I hope you understand. But please come join our Facebook group, Southern Fried True Crime Fans Discretion Group, where we swap recipes, worship Dolly Parton, and share memes. I much prefer spending my social media time in our lovely group. We do, of course, discuss true crime, not just Southern Fried, but all kinds. But it is still very much a Southern lifestyle group. Our group is a safe and fun corner of Facebook, and by God, we mean it when we say no shit ass is allowed. It's not just a motto, it's how we run the group. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe, and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on all large platforms like iHeart, Stitcher, Spotify, Spreaker, and now Amazon and Audible. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Y'all take care.